specializing in personal injury law. Levin and Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levineandlevine.com. Coming up next, Sojourner Truth Radio.
Tune in on Thursday, August 30th at 8 p.m. to celebrate the Native programmers and the Native community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Jack Malmstrom of Rose City Native Radio will host this special on-air program. You can join us at the Native Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 30th. More information about the Native Community Open House and the anniversary programming can be found at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. A U.S. federal court struck down North Carolina's congressional map on Monday, August 27th, ahead of the U.S. midterm elections, ruling that districts were unconstitutionally gerrymandered to favor the GOP, this part of a GOP strategy for voter suppression. Our guest is Barbara Arnwine, veteran civil rights and human rights leader and advocate. She is the executive director of the Transformative Justice Coalition. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, African-American journalist and political prisoner who has been detained in Pennsylvania since 1981 under alleged charges of killing a police officer, will soon appear in court again on Thursday, August 30th. He was sentenced to death the year after his arrest and conviction in 1981. Since then, he has tried to appeal his conviction at least five times, but he may now have another chance. Our guest is Pam Africa, the head of the International Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the International Monetary Fund is due to visit the island nation of Barbados again this week. And they are proposing austerity measures that the country must repay its debt to multilateral financial institutions, that wages must be contained, and government pensions reform. They're also encouraging privatization of state-owned enterprises. What does all of this mean for the new Prime Minister of Barbados, the first woman elected as Prime Minister, Mia Mottley? How are people on the ground responding? And what role does the demand of Barbados and other island nations in the region for reparations from the UK and France for the cost of slavery and all of the repercussions that are still around today? Our guest is David Commission, an advisor to Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley on the Caribbean Community or CARICOM affairs. He is also with the Caribbean Pan-African Network. He is based, of course, in Barbados. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A progressive Bernie Sanders-backed Florida Democrat pulled off an upset victory Tuesday in the state's primary for governor. Meanwhile, President Trump's favored candidate cruised to victory for the GOP. Democratic Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum would be the state's first black governor. He and Trump-backed Republican Representative Ron DeSantis both beat more establishment candidates. In a tweet praising DeSantis, President Trump called Gillum, quote, a failed socialist mayor. Speaking on CNN this morning, Gillum responded that Floridians will choose the politics of unity over division.
Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis are both scraping from the bottom of the barrel. I actually believe that Florida and its rich diversity are going to be looking for a governor who's going to bring us together, not divide us, not misogynist, not racist, not bigots. They're going to be looking for a governor who is going to appeal to our higher aspirations as a state.
In Arizona, Representative Martha McSally fended off a pair of far-right Trump-backed challengers in Kelly Ward and former Sheriff Joe Arpaio to carry the Republican Senate primary to fill the seat vacated by retiring Senator Jeff Flake. The death of Senator John McCain cast a shadow over that race. Governor Doug Ducey will name McCain's replacement after the senator's funeral. Florida and Arizona are being watched as possible bellwethers for the November midterm elections. Arizonans will have an opportunity to give a final farewell to Senator John McCain today at the Arizona State Capitol during the first of 2 days of services in Phoenix before McCain departs for Washington. A private ceremony will be held today at the Capitol Rotunda. Later, the Capitol will be open to members of the public who want to pay their respects. A church service will be held on Thursday at North Phoenix Baptist Church. From there, McCain will depart Arizona for the last time. Another viewing will be held at the U.S. Capitol on Friday, with a final memorial service at the Washington National Cathedral. More testimony is expected today during the sentencing of a former Texas police officer who was convicted of murder for shooting into a car filled with black teenagers in suburban Dallas, killing one of them. In a rare guilty verdict in a police shooting case, the Dallas County jurors were not swayed by former Balch Springs officer Roy Oliver's claim that he was protecting his partner when he fired into the vehicle. His partner told jurors he didn't fear for his life. Attorney Darrell Washington represented the relatives of the victim, 15-year-old Jordan Edwards. He said the verdict sends a larger message.
This case, it's not just about Jordan, it's about Tamir Rice. It's about Walter Scott.
Yeah. Yes.
It's about Ernest Alton Sterling. Mm-hmm. It's about every African-American, unarmed African-American who have been killed and who have not gotten justice.
Oliver was found not guilty on two lesser charges of aggravated assault stemming from the shooting. At sentencing, Oliver could face up to life in prison. President Trump is accusing Google and other U.S. tech companies of rigging search results about him so that almost all stories and news is bad. And though he's offering no evidence, a top advisor says the White House is taking a look at whether Google should face federal regulation. Google is pushing back sharply, saying Trump's claim simply wasn't true. In a statement, it said, quote, "We never rank search results to manipulate political sentiment." The president's tweets Tuesday echoed his familiar attacks on the news media and a conservative talking point that California-based tech companies run by CEOs with liberal leanings don't give equal weight to opposing political viewpoints. They also revealed anew his deep-seated frustration over not getting the credit he believes he deserves. The president jumped onto Twitter before dawn Tuesday to rehash his recent complaints about alleged suppression of conservative voices and positive news about him. He followed that up with vague threats in Oval Office comments. California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill into law that makes California the first state to overhaul its money bail system. Backers of the new law say it will eliminate a system that unfairly penalizes the poor, Pacifica's Dan Fritz reports.
The bill was co-authored by a Van Nuys legislator, State Senator Bob Hertzberg.
Roughly 63% of those detained in our county jails here in California have not been convicted, have not been sentenced. They're either awaiting trial or awaiting sentencing. And they are there for one reason, one wrong reason. They can't afford to leave.
Under the legislation, people arrested on suspicion of criminal offenses can be held in jail only if they pose a significant risk to public safety or risk missing their court date. The legislation allows for non-monetary release conditions for eligible defendants, such as GPS monitoring or home detention with electronic monitoring. The law is getting criticism from Republicans who say it'll result in less supervision for criminals. Opponents say the law relies on flawed algorithms to assess the risk of suspects, including a scoring system that uses zip codes and employment data as proxies for race and economic status. Dan Fritz, Pacifica Radio KPFK, Los Angeles.
A small earthquake has rattled Southern California, but there are no immediate reports of damage or injuries. The U.S. Geological Survey says a magnitude 4.4 earthquake struck about 7:30 Tuesday. It was centered about 25 miles east of downtown Los Angeles. The quake shook buildings for several seconds in downtown L.A. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Before we go to our first segment here, for our Southern California listeners, the 10th annual Leimert Park Village Heritage Festival will take place Labor Day weekend, September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's 3 days from 10 in the morning to 7 in the evening. That's Saturday to Monday. That's going to be on Deegan between 43rd Street and 43rd Place of Crenshaw and Vernon in Los Angeles. It's free to all. But there's an entertainment lineup that includes the James Brown All-Star Band, Greg Wright, Wadada Kafu, Jai Jai Kabas, and more. You can get more information by going to Leimert Park Village Heritage Festival.com. That is Leimert Park Village Heritage Festival.com, or you can call 213-290-3831. That's 213-290-3831. So a lot of fun there for all with the 10th annual Leimert Park Village Heritage Festival. Now, a U.S. federal court struck down North Carolina's congressional map on Monday, August 27th, this ahead of the midterm elections, but after primaries had already been held. That it rules that districts were unconstitutionally gerrymandered to favor the Republicans. Gerrymandering is a practice intended to establish a political advantage for a particular party or group by manipulating district boundaries. This takes place within the context of increased efforts at voter suppression stepped up after the Supreme Court gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act. Of course, the Voting Rights Act was a key victory of the civil rights movement. Now, last Monday, August 27th, a three-judge federal court found that Republican legislators in North Carolina violated both the First and 14th Amendments when they drew congressional lines that favored their party. This, according to a report from Politico. The court acted under an order of the U.S. Supreme Court to examine the case, which was introduced by election advocacy groups and Democrats who had sued to challenge the boundaries drawn in 2016. Plaintiffs in the case include the Democratic Party and civil rights organizations. The court is now set to appoint something called a special master to draw up a map, giving North Carolina lawmakers a chance to draw their own constituency compliant map before September 17th, which is the deadline. The approved maps could then be used during November's midterm elections. There's a lot of confusion about how all that is going to be organized. North Carolina state legislature, it should be noted, is dominated by Republican lawmakers, many of whom are supporters of Donald Trump. This could have decisive implications for midterm elections. But also keep in mind that North Carolina is the place where Moral Mondays, which was headed by the Reverend William Barber, who's now gone on to found the Poor People's Campaign, where they have been successfully organizing in that state. So there is a strong grassroots movement on the ground in North Carolina. Now, here to discuss all of this with us, I'd like to welcome back the terrific Barbara Arnwine, veteran civil rights and human rights leader and advocate. She is the executive director of Transformative Justice Coalition, and for several decades, for 26 years, she was the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and she is known nationally and internationally for her work in the 1991 Civil Rights Act and much more. She's a prize-winning campaigner there. Barbara Arnwine, welcome back.
Well, it's great to be on your show. What a news day. So much going on.
I'm telling you, what about this, the thing that happened in Florida? What a shock.
Yes.
With
yes. And yeah. I'm so disgusted with all these political commentators talking about, oh, this is a shift to the left. It's a shift to the left. It's Bernie's doing. First of all, people forget that, Bernie Sanders only went to Florida one time campaigning for Andrew Gillum. And second, they forget that Andrew Gillum was running against, you know, two other very, very top-ranked candidates. But the reason why people liked him was his ideas. He had some really strong positions that he took. And instead of talking about this as a populist movement, this represents, you know, people's desire for gun control, people's desire for health care, people's desire, you know, for all of these, you know, platforms that he ran on. Instead, they're talking about a shift to the left. I mean, what kind of nonsense is that? So I just think that, you know, it's very important for people to look at that and then also think about it. 1.4 million Democrats came out and voted.
Yeah.
Imagine that. For a primary in Florida. So this is, really quite, that's the come out of state to watch.
Yeah, that's the big happens. The big news that coming out of the primaries that were held yesterday. So you're going to have, in a southern state, a black man up against a conservative right-wing candidate who is endorsed and is the darling of Donald Trump. What a matchup that's going to be.
Oh, it's going to be really quite the matchup. I mean, I think this is, we always knew that this Florida's election, because of Proposition 4, which would restore the right to vote to 1.4 million people with, quote, felony convictions in their background to returning citizens, that we always knew it was going to be a race to watch and to watch what was happening in that state for November 6th. But my goodness, now it takes on a whole other, you know, connotation. So I think it's amazing. Also, look at the black vote in Florida. I mean, this is something else that's really remarkable. I mean, the black vote is estimated to have turned out at about, you know, there's 1.3 million new black voters in Florida. And it's estimated that that vote turned out at a heavy percentage.
Right. Well,
this primary. So that's even more to watch.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, a cautionary tale in all of this and the importance of turnout is, although the Democratic turnout was high for a primary and the black vote, particularly very high, especially supporting Andrew Gillum, who is now the Democratic Party candidate for governor in Florida. The GOP turnout, though, percentage-wise, was higher than the Democratic Party turnout. So that is a cautionary tale. And also, we're hearing some concerns that the Latino vote is not turning out or registering in the numbers that people had hoped. But in the lead-up to the election, Gwen Graham, whose dad was a governor who had a lot of name recognition, she was really expected to win, and Philip Levine was second, and Andrew Gillum was third, but here he is pulling it out. So we'll see how all of that goes.
It's what I always say, Margaret, is that polls don't vote. People vote.
Yeah.
And the only thing that counts on election day is it has nothing to do with the polls. It has everything to do with the voters. So it's ultimately all about voter turnout and voter participation.
Right. I'm glad we really got to that. Really exciting night. Andrew Gillum, 34.3% of the vote. Graham, 31.3% of the vote. And Levine, who was supposed to come in second, he trailed Philip Levine with 20.3% of the vote. So here you have Andrew Gillum, black man, going to be up against Ron DeSantis, a darling of Fox News and of Donald Trump. But Barbara, just focusing now on this, what's going on in North Carolina and this gerrymandering, because the court, they have ruled against the Democrats in a number of these challenges, like in Texas, also in Wisconsin, but they've also ruled against Republicans in terms of gerrymandering. In Maryland, the court declined a request by Republican voters in the 6th District. Maryland. So tell us what this means, because I really see the whole gerrymandering thing as part of the whole voter suppression effort that you have been so critical in campaigning against for some time now, Barbara Arnwine.
Well, thank you. You know, as you are aware, we have been holding hearings of what's called the National Commission for Voter Justice. And we've been going around the country documenting, you know, voter suppression, barriers to votes, the problems that voters face. And when we were in Wisconsin, we actually had plaintiffs from the Gill versus Whitford case testify, including their lawyer their lead lawyer sat as one of our commissioners. So we heard a lot about this case, and we got to see what was going on first. You know, what people need to understand is that partisan gerrymandering really is a huge problem for many voters in quite a number of states. This is not a southern problem. It's not a midwestern problem. It is a national problem of partisan gerrymandering. Each case has different fact situations. You really can't look to Texas to determine, you know, what will happen in North Carolina, because there, you know, you had a map that had been drawn by the, you know, by the court itself that Texas lazily just decided to adopt instead of, you know, drawing their own map as the court wanted them to do. And when the Supreme Court got the case, they said, well, you know, the court can't be angry because they, you know, adopted the same map that the court had drawn. So that's a, you know, very different factual situation. Here in North Carolina, this three-judge panel had, you know, previously heard this case and had, you know, found that the map was unconstitutional because it violated, you know, not only Article 1 of the Constitution, which says that the people shall elect their congressional representatives, but also violated the First Amendment, right of free association, and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that is very interesting because not all of these cases have had a strong First Amendment basis for the litigation. Remember that Kagan and Whitford criticized the plaintiffs for not really pursuing their First Amendment claim. And she actually wrote what I would call the roadmap for this decision, because this decision is very much grounded in Justice Kagan's dissent. Her concurrence in Whitford is very much based on her opinion in the Whitford case. And what is very good about this case is that a lot of people said, okay, you know, Gill versus Whitford sets a new standing requirement for these cases, because Gill versus Whitford says you can't just attack a state redistricting map for everything it does wrong at statewide, that you had to have plaintiffs from each of the congressional districts, or each of the districts that were being challenged to, you know, raise their complaints, you know, separately, individually, and to show that individually and separately that they were being denied a constitutional right to vote. Well, what's neat is that Judge James A. Wynn Jr. of the U.S. Court of Appeals for Circuit, who was sitting as part of this three-judge panel and wrote the decision, what he makes very clear is that they met that standard here, because because in this case, they did have plaintiffs who were from each of the 13 congressional districts at issue here, and that they were able to show that they had been denied a very fundamental right by not having the ability to elect a congressional representative of their choice. Instead, what happened?
Just let me ask you this, though, because the we're a little short of time here, but the three-judge federal court, they're said to be giving the parties a choice to redraw the state's maps or use the maps in place from 2016. So there's some confusion about
the whole
election. Repeat that.
They also said they might suspend the whole election.
Wow.
That's another option they put out there. I mean, this is radical. I mean, they put out the option that there may not be an election for Congress while they try to sort through this. So they put out several options, and the party's got to respond by Friday as to what they would like the court to do.
Right. Well, we're certainly gonna need to follow this up as the battle continues. Barbara Arnwine, on so many different fronts, right? You have this voter suppression going on, and if that doesn't tell people about the importance that some of particularly on the conservative side put on voting, they should think again. Pam, we are going to have to leave it there, but for people who want to find out more about the work that you're doing on this on your organization and also the National Commission for Voter Justice, what should they do?
They can go and follow us at tjcoalition.org. They can also follow the work of the National Commission at nationalcvj.org. We are holding more hearings. We're coming to Ohio, and we're on our way to Texas, here in Texas and Oklahoma. But it's so important in this decision that, you know, that we don't allow legislators to draw maps for themselves for partisan advantage.
That's right.
Must be able to elect their own candidates without a partisan thumb on the scale.
Absolutely. Well, Barbara Arnwine, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Take care. Bye-bye.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, Mamiya Abu-Jamal is an internationally celebrated Black writer and journalist. His journalism at the time of his arrest, he was arrested back in 1981 under alleged charges of killing a policeman. But his writing exposed racist policing, corrupt government practices, injustice within the U.S. penal system. He also did a supporter of Philadelphia's MOVE organization, MOVE made famous, unfortunately, when the mayor, Rizzo, of that city literally bombed the several homes where MOVE members lived. Now, Mamiya has been in prison since 1981, but he's going to appear in court again tomorrow, August 30th. He was sentenced to death the year after his arrest and conviction, and since then he has tried to appeal his conviction at least five times. Many people are hoping that he will have another chance. For full disclosure, I helped to do a national call for journalists in support of Mumia. This was several years back, the last time he was due to appear in court. Now, according to Sputnik News, his new legal strategy will argue that Ronald Castile, a former district attorney whose office prosecuted Abu Jamal's case, was improperly involved in his appeal after becoming a state Supreme Court justice. So here to break all of this down for us and let us know the latest of what's going on, we want to welcome back to Sojourner Truth the well-known Pam Africa, head of the International Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia Abu Jamal, organization based in Philadelphia, but it is at the center of an international movement seeking Mumia's release. Pam Africa, welcome. Pam Africa, can you hear me? I'm not hearing Pam. Hello, Pam, are you there?
Yes, I am. And my phone was on mute.
Oh, your phone was on mute, so you were talking.
It was on
couldn't
mute.
Hear
I'm
you.
Just talking away, and you saying, Pam, Pam. Right, I know we pressed the time, and but what I want to point out is, you know, where the case is at now, we have a very progressive and, you know, a DA by the name of Larry Krasner.
Yeah.
He has been helpful in a whole lot of the, you know, police brutality cases, bringing charges, you know, getting rid of, you know, some, you know, bad DAs and, you know, releasing people from jail that shouldn't have been in jail, you know, the young juvenile lifers.
Yeah.
And what I find about Mr. Krasner is that he's no different than the DAs before him.
Uh-oh.
Because here you have a case with all this information. We're going back before the courts tomorrow, but this district attorney said that this case has no merit. And, you know, and which showed what we were telling people, that people be one way on the outside, but when they get on that inside and they in that, you know, they might have been demons before they got there, but I'm saying demon because only a person who knows full well and his staff that he moved in there, you know, moved in when he became DA, people who rallied around, who put information out about the innocence of Mumia, about all these wrongs that's happening. And, you know, and this DA getting here, and the first thing he does as DA.
Wow.
You know, and this is during the time that we're in court, you know, battling the injustice that Supreme Court Justice Ron Castile not only did with Mumia, and we're in court with him, but while this is going on, the newly elected DA called to have, you know, the Supreme Court justice as a person who heads his retention. I mean, you know, when they bring in, you know, new DAs and, you know, tell them, you know, what's right and what's wrong, you know, guide them through this. He calls for Supreme Court Justice Ron Castile. And also, right then and there, we started demonstrating against Ron Castile. But you deal with people who say, you know, well, you know, he did, you know, it wasn't until he got in that he let Debbie go. You know, that he signed papers saying that move, you know, people should be eligible for parole. You know, he talked about the three women. He said because there's no harm to the community.
Well,
yes, he did do that.
Let me ask you this, Pam. I hear everything that you're saying, a lot of disappointment there with Larry Krasner. Now, just to fill our audience in, Ronald Castile became an assistant Philadelphia district attorney in 1971 and a senior assistant at the time of Mumia's 1982 trial. Then in 1985, he was elected as district attorney and was district attorney during the preparation and legal argument of Mumia Abu Jamal's direct appeal from his 1982 conviction and death sentence. But Mumia had made motions for Justice Castile to recuse himself on the basis of bias and conflict of interest. But of course, Castile didn't do that. So this is now an important part of what Mumia is going to be facing tomorrow. And some disappointment on the on the DA side. But, you know, anybody who's been following this case, or even for people who are now hearing something about it, there's, you know, nobody really believes that Ronald Castile was not prejudiced against Mumia and therefore should have recused himself. You know what I mean, Pam?
Right, right. So, in going into there tomorrow, and all, you know, we have a lot of people, you know, the pressure got to be on, the truth. And sister, I thank you so much for making this perfectly clear. And I got so much on my head right now, and I'm here, there, and everywhere. And I love that you brought it back to the point. I love you. I respect you. And professional, humane journalism. And I just got to say that. And but, you know, tomorrow we have a lot of people, you know, that came from out the country, raised, Fanon, the daughter of our brother France Fanon. Journalist, you know, who had the largest newspapers over, you know, in France. We got people who are coming from Senegal and are all to be here. Well, we're doing a press conference this evening at 4:00.
Okay.
But they want to be here, and they want to let people know why they coming here, because of everything that you just said, and they just cannot sit by and allow the situation to happen. And I'm going to send you some things that was, you know, sent to me, if you send me your email, and when you send me your email, that, you know, just came out. And
right, and we're going to continue to follow this, because there, from what I understand, there is evidence that Castile did have direct involvement and called for the death penalty for Mumia. But Krasner's office is saying, well, they can find the memo. They can find it after an exhaustive search. I mean, come on, okay? So,
but you know what they do have is him lying. And because what he said, that no one filed appeal to him, and we got the paperwork where he turned it down. Twice when he appealed. But he's saying to the media that, you know, he know nothing about this. So I'm saying, you know, right there, and that should send, you know, flags up. And then for him to say that, you know, Mumia wanted him off the case also behind the fact that he's a lifetime member of the Fraternal Order Police.
That's
he
right.
He said they give him money. He said that they're his support. And, you know, he's a lifetime member of the people that, you know, it's a conflict of interest. You know, with that as well, he should have recused himself.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But they said there's no reason and it's without merit.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Well, we'll see. Pam Africa, please keep us posted. We're going to continue to follow this. The new filing says the high profile and political sensitivity of Mr. Abu Jamal's case increases the likelihood that Justice Castile's minimization of his involvement in the case was not credible and is still not credible, as far as myself and so many others. And Pam, it's terrific that you have supporters. You've organized that coming from around the world in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We appreciate you. We appreciate your work. And please give our best to Sister Ramona Africa as well.
I sure will. I'd like to come on and give an update a little bit later, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much. And we also want to thank our sister Phoebe Joan Schellenberg for her help with this segment today. Thank you, Pam. All the best. All righty. This is Margaret Prescott. We're going to take a short station break. And coming up, the International Monetary Fund is at it again, putting the squeeze on the small island nation, my home country of Barbados. David Kamisiong joins us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 8:37. This is KBOO Press Watch coming up at 9. And then at 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to Dow Strom about her new collection of poetic fragments, You'll Always Be Someone from Somewhere Else. This is KBOO.
Something that touched my heart, and it began this way. I was born by the river in a little tent and just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
The late, great, our sister, our family, the late, great Aretha Franklin singing A Change Is Gonna Come. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you miss any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. You could also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, and our Twitter handle is at So True Radio. And we are also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out to actually all of our SoundCloud listeners who are fans of Aretha and who are mourning the loss of this great voice. There'll never be another Aretha Franklin. We also want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the island nation of Barbados. And just to give you a little update on news on Aretha, members of Aretha's sorority, Delta Sigma Theta, hosted a memorial service for her on Thursday, August 28th at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, where her body is there for people to come in and view her. And apparently she is decked out all in red shoes and nail polish and lipstick and dress, and Aretha even in death looks terrific. Fans are currently waiting in line at her public viewing. Her service will begin at Greater Grace Temple in Detroit and will feature a caravan of more than 100 cars. We encourage you to really check to see what news outlets will be carrying Aretha's funeral live. The artist lineup includes Stevie Wonder, Faith Hill, Jennifer Hudson, Ron Isley, Chaka Khan, and the Aretha Franklin Choir. And I understand as of today, Ariana Grande is going to be joining the lineup, and many more. It's really going to be something as the world remembers Aretha Franklin. She's getting less coverage now because the media are all over the primary elections, but also the passing of Senator McCain, who also will be lying in state. But we want to bring information to you about what's going on with Aretha. We are now going to continue our discussion as part of our occasional South of the Border series as we examine other parts of the Americas, in this instance the island nation of Barbados. May of this year, 2018, Barbados elected its first woman prime minister, Mia Mottley. She is facing an economy on the downside, described by economists as in recession. Her administration agrees with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, that the economy of Barbados, according to the IMF, is in a precarious state. But there's disagreement on what is to be done about it. The opposition to Mia's government has said that the prime minister has to come clean about cuts in jobs and rises in bus fares. On the other hand, the prime minister has reportedly said that there will be no mass layoffs and that she plans on lessening the pain, austerity pain, on the most vulnerable Barbadians, who are single heads of households and the elderly, and she also hopes to shorten austerity measures. Of course, the IMF, due to visit Barbados again this week, is, as they generally do to countries in need of financial support, they are proposing austerity measures, that the country repay its debt to multilateral financial institutions, that wages must be contained, and government pensions reformed. They are encouraging privatization of state-owned enterprises. But the IMF plan is not new. Governments of the Global South all too often end up saddled with debt, in some instances the repayment on the interest alone of that debt to the IMF or the World Bank can be more than their expenditure on government services to their people. One example in the region is Jamaica, who some years back, their economy, some economists claim, was seriously undermined, some went as far as saying destroyed by austerity measures imposed by the IMF. And most recently in Haiti, an uprising broke out, an insurrection broke out across the country when their U.S.-backed government tried to implement IMF measures there, specifically increasing the cost of gas and fuel. The Haitian government had to back down and rescind the price increases, and the prime minister of Haiti forced to resign. So how all of this is going to play out in Barbados, it remains to be seen. And this, by the way, in the midst of Barbados playing a key role along with other island nations in demanding reparations from the UK, also from France, for slavery and the damage done to generations since slavery still being felt today in the region. Indeed, CARICOM has a lawsuit going, Caribbean heads of state, the governments in the Caribbean region on that point. And before we welcome our guest, let us hear a bit from Mia Motley, the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister herself, talking about the dire economic situation on the island.
We believe that we have a duty to share with the country really what is the first substantive cabinet meeting, what the state of affairs are with the country. We continue to have a tenuous state with respect to our foreign reserves, and in the circumstances, our foreign debt payments, as we indicated during the course of the other activities in the last few weeks, that we had a date with destiny. Our date with destiny starts from Tuesday with foreign debt payments between the 5th of June and the 18th of June, which represents a high point of foreign debt payments for us over the course of the month of June.
Okay, well, just I shortened that clip to give our guest some time, a bit more time to share his thoughts on all of this. I'd like to welcome David Commission, an advisor to Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley on Caribbean Community CARICOM affairs. He's also active in the Caribbean Pan-African Network. He, of course, is based in Barbados, a longtime writer, political activist. He's also an attorney. He is the author of the 2013 book, It's the Healing of the Nation, The Case for Reparations in an Era of Recession and Recolonization. He's also the author of Marching Down the Wide Streets of Tomorrow, Emancipation, Essays and Speeches. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Margaret. It's a pleasure to be here. I just want to correct one thing quickly.
Please do.
CARICOM nations have not filed a reparations lawsuit against the European governments. What they have done is having launched the reparations campaign and established the CARICOM Reparations Commission. They have written to all of the Western European nations that were implicated in slavery and have put the demand for reparations to them, and have suggested in the first instance that we negotiate this demand. So a lawsuit may eventually come, but it's not there right now.
Right, right. Well, perhaps that was a bit more hopeful, but good that some efforts are being made along those lines. And before we talk a bit more about the movement for reparations, because I really see this connected with the kind of economic crisis facing Barbados, but so many of the small island nations with the hurricanes, you know, devastating Dominica, you know, and some other as well. So tell us your thoughts on what you think is happening now. I mean, you have the IMF putting the squeeze on Barbados, as they did with Haiti, as they did with Jamaica, and it seems as though the Prime Minister, Mia Motley, has a very difficult course to walk here. So your thoughts on this?
Let's be very clear. Barbados is a member of the IMF. The IMF didn't come to Barbados. Barbados was a member of the IMF, went to the IMF requesting financial assistance. The reality is that for over a decade, Barbados had a very dysfunctional government, a government that did not provide leadership and that permitted the country to become enmeshed in an economic slide that has gone on for a good decade or so. Barbados is now the third most indebted country in the world after Japan and Greece. So the Barbadian people totally rejected that administration. In fact, they voted all of them out of office on the 24th of May, so disgusted were the people. So Ms. Motley is leading a very powerful government. When Ms. Motley came to power, the country had enough foreign exchange to cover a mere 7 weeks of imports.
Wow.
The country did not have the foreign exchange to meet international debt payments. So Ms. Motley's government immediately suspended all debt payments, including international debt payments, and initiated negotiations with the IMF. Now, Barbados is not Haiti or Jamaica. Barbados has had two experiences with the IMF in the past, in the early 80s and the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Barbados was in and out within 18 months, a year and a half. Barbados, in its negotiations with the IMF in the past, has refused to devalue its currency, has refused to carry out any large scale retrenchment of workers, and so our experience with the IMF in the past has not been the kind of devastating experience that, say, Jamaica had, when Jamaica found itself in a program for decades that gutted public education, social welfare services, and the country probably has never recovered from that experience. Ms. Motley very early on sent a signal, a very important signal, when one of the first measures she did upon taking office was to reinstitute our system of free university education.
Uh-huh.
So the message is that even in a period of economic crisis, we recognize that investment in developing the educational standards of our people is not some kind of luxury. This is a key element of our national development model and therefore has to be prioritized. She also, in the midst of this economic crisis, increased welfare provisions, because we in Barbados understand that there must be a minimum below which people are not permitted to fall, that we must be a civilized society in which people's human needs must be catered for. So what I'm saying is this: Barbados has a social democratic model of governance and society, mixed economy, an investment in public health care, public education, certain minimum welfare standards. And, we are not going to dismantle that. Yes, we are going to negotiate with the IMF. We know that there are certain things that we have to do. There's certain revamping of our public sector that needs to take place. We have to be more efficient. They're probably going to, Ms. Motley has already signaled that we do have an excess burden of labor within the public sector. We're going to have to shed some of that, but not the kind of thousands that was being touted by certain advisors and entities, and that even where some public servants are going to have to be let go, that they're not just going to be abandoned. You know, we are going to work with the trade unions. We're going to put measures in place, whether people are assisted to transition into self-employment. Some people will be given land or land made available to them. In other words, we will be exploring all kinds of mechanisms to ensure that this adjustment is not some kind of calamity, you know?
Yeah, and I was struck by the Prime Minister also saying, I mean, I actually listened to most of that presentation, and, you know, her concern about single heads of households, for example, most of whom are women. And I had seen also her meeting with sugarcane workers, with in particular talking about the needs of women and the lack of pensions for sugarcane workers. Of course, sugar being, you know, and sugarcane still being a critical part of the economy in addition to tourism. But I also wanted to ask, in addition to the IMF, if there are other avenues. I hear what you're saying about the IMF, and the Prime Minister has actually said that she hopes quickly for Barbados to be out of, you said before, 18 months. I think she's hoping for even less this time for involvement with the IMF.
So, well, she's hoping to wrap up the negotiations very quickly. We don't want any prolonged negotiation. So that's what she's saying. We want a quick negotiation with the IMF, work out the package and get going, because having suspended debt payments, there's a price you pay for that. All the international rating agencies now downgrade you
because you're
not paying your debt.
David, let me ask you this quickly, because there are two things I want to cover and time is going by quickly. I'm wondering, are there other avenues? I mean, we know that there's Petrocaribe with Venezuela that has provided so much assistance to so many. We know that Venezuela is facing a crisis, a lot of destabilization, the U.S. in particular having a hand in that, but also the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa, they met recently in a BRICS Plus meeting, as they called it, where other countries, including some from the Caribbean, I think maybe Jamaica was involved, and they have a new development bank. And then there's also Mercosur. In other words, I'm wondering if there are other entities that go outside of the traditional IMF World Bank type structures that is being considered here?
No. Well, you know, what you're asking is an academic question, because the decision has already been taken.
Uh-huh.
The new government feels that they need the IMF, they need to get involved in that IMF program, because it then sends a signal to the entire...
This is not instead of IMF.
...financial establishment.
Yeah.
And then secondly, the IMF funding is going to come at a 1% interest rate. You can't get that interest rate anywhere else. Not with Petrocaribe, not with, you know, BRICS, nowhere.
Okay.
So...
The
Barbados government is convinced that it needs to have this settlement with the IMF, have the IMF stamp of approval for the restructuring program that Barbados is going to go through, get the IMF finances at a 1% interest rate, get back the confidence of the international banking and financial establishment, and move forward. And we want to do this as quickly as possible. So the point I'm making, Margaret, is I don't think you can use the experience of other countries to determine what will be the Barbados experience with the IMF, because the reality is that back in the early 90s, when we went into that IMF program, the IMF was insisting that we devalue the Barbados dollar. Incidentally, the Barbados dollar is 2 Barbados dollars to 1 US, And it has been that way virtually from the time Barbados became independent in the 1960s. And the Barbados government said to the IMF, no, we will not be devaluing. Do away with free education. Free tertiary, because we have free tertiary education at the University of the West Indies. No. So Barbados has a record of being able to stand up to an agency like the IMF and say, we will not be dismantling the fundamentals of our system. And we don't expect this experience to be any different.
Well, that's very good to know, David. And here's the dilemma. Last time you were on last week, I said this week I wanted to talk with you about the reparations and the movement and BUSA and all of that. We still haven't gotten to it. So that means we need a part three, David, okay? So we'll be back in touch, and I promise we'll get to that.
CARICOM. I am
all right.
Now the Barbados ambassador to CARICOM.
Right.
We
have a lot to talk about, and I got to wrap it up and get off the air right now. But David, we appreciate you, and thank you so much for joining us. All the best.
My pleasure, Margaret. Anytime.
Okay. We are out of time. I'd like to thank our entire team there. Our board op today, Gary Baca, our assistant producer, Romero Funes, today's show produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. We are going to have a Labor Day special that will be on the air tomorrow. We hope that you tune in for that. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
And you are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and online at kboo.org. Coming up this morning at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to Dow Strom about her new collection of poetic fragments, You'll Always Be Someone from Somewhere Else. But next, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, and if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film, from 1980, chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances.